Ho!
Good morning. It is a lovely Sunday afternoon as I'm recording this, and it is my first day back home, which explains my slight tardiness on getting this episode out to y'all. Very sorry about that, but I hope you enjoy this thorough analysis of, that's right, character in Oliver Twist. Hello and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now put away that fruitcake and let's begin. So Oliver Twist, or The Parish Boy's Progress, was written by Charles Dickens in 1838, and like many of his novels, first came out in installments in the newspaper, and he published them under a pseudonym, which was Boz in this case. This next fact makes total sense to me now after having read the book, but Dickens actually wrote it with the intent to display his view of how increased poverty escalates crime. Much of this information, by the way, I'm getting from Britannica, which is linked below. Now on to the meat of the novel. The book is written in a lovely Dickensian third person, semi-omniscient style where Dickens, for the most part, follows the motivations of Oliver Twist, while every so often adding his own commentary and hints into the mix. Sometimes, like at the end of the book, this takes the form of Dickens sprinkling I statements in, but other times his influence is more subtle, like with the titles of every chapter. For example, I would show Rose Maylie in all the bloom and the grace of early womanhood, shedding upon her secluded path in life such soft and gentle light as fell on all who trod it with her and shone into their hearts. I would paint her the life and joy of the fireside circle and the lively summer group. I would follow her through the sultry fields at noon and hear the tones of her sweet voice in the moonlit evening walk, etc., etc. The sentence goes on for the rest of the paragraph. Some exemplary chapter titles include, quote, A Strange Interview, which is a sequel to the last chapter, in which the reader, if he or she resort to the fifth chapter of this second book, will perceive a contrast not uncommon in matrimonial cases, and reverts to the merry old gentleman and his useful friends, though whom a new acquaintance is introduced to the intelligent reader and connected with whom various pleasant matters are related appertaining to this history. Pretty cool, right? The book begins with Oliver's birth in a gruesome and dark place. His mother, reportedly strong and stubborn, has traveled much out of her way, in labor nonetheless, to give birth to him in an out-of-the-way place, way outside of London. The baby, too, seems to be quite strong, as he's left on his mother's death, an orphan, and sent to a child farm to grow up. Dickens' words, not mine. Oliver's upbringing, if you can call it that, lasts 8 years until he asks for more food on a night when he is absolutely starving. His offense at the child farm is so egregious that the masters decide to give him and £5 away to anyone who would take Oliver as their apprentice. He's taken in by a coffin maker. What's important about this series of events in terms of Oliver's character is that we are made painfully clear as readers as to how adverse his circumstances actually are, and how bold he is to willingly commit such a bad so-called crime in light of those circumstances. Minor character-wise, there's a bit early on about the beadle, aka Mr. Bumble, or the person who runs the orphanage. You may actually remember him from last week, I think we read a passage with him in it. But all of that seems to foreshadow the shallowness and predictability of his character when he becomes more important later on. Continuing on, the coffinmaker's place is so terrible for Oliver, especially with the other apprentice Noah Claypool around, that he decides to run away on foot, destination London. Again, we get clues here as to how extraordinary Oliver is by his decision to walk such a distance in his already impoverished state. In fact, he barely makes it, but his hope snags him from death seemingly at the last moment. I think that this is one of the most crucial turning points in Oliver's character in the book, because here we can finally start to see how genuine he is despite his circumstances. On his route, Oliver meets Jack Dawkins, aka the Artful Dodger, who feeds him and takes him to Fagin's place. But now it's painfully clear what Oliver is getting himself into, though he doesn't know it yet. In fact, the next day, Oliver is taken out to watch the boys work, where they begin to steal things from strangers' pockets. Oliver is horrified and bolts from the scene, only to be accused and then acquitted of being a pickpocket himself. The victim, Mr. Brownlow, takes him in where he's able to recover and then receive the best treatment he has ever had in his life. True depth is added to Oliver's character here because of the way he reacts to kindness, which is by reciprocating it, and to art and beauty. It speaks to Dickens' opinion of children when he writes a character that's so pure despite his horrid upbringing. It's clear by this point that in terms of character, there are two factions emerging, those on the side of the good and those on the side of evil. Neither side is looked into very closely yet, since we're still within the first 150 pages or so, but we'll get there, don't worry. Enter Bill Sykes, Fagin, and Nancy, all partners in the underground pickpocket trade, who are concerned that Oliver will rat them out in his new position. They make a plan and are able to recapture Oliver, who's held against his will for who knows how long, so that Fagin can try to rebrand him as a bona fide pickpocket himself. Nancy begins to feel guilty, though, and often steps in on Oliver's behalf. Here's the part where I think it's appropriate to talk about Nancy in more depth. So, she is a prostitute and part of the crime hub, but a woman nonetheless, so she often gets pitted with tasks and faults not befitting to her, yet she takes them in stride and plays all of the games she has to keep herself alive. She has tremendous pluck and she's caught in the dichotomy that she is supposed to be dainty and pure, but still is in the underground and degrades herself for a living. She has the sensibilities of a woman, so she often passes out and takes pains to protect others with no gains to herself, but she ultimately belongs entirely to the wrong crowds. At this point, Sykes is planning a big robbery, and Oliver is volunteered for the job. It ends poorly, however, with Oliver shot in the arm and nothing quite stolen. Fortunately, though, Oliver is taken in by the kind household and adopted into yet another well-to-do family. Meanwhile, Sykes speaks secretly to a man named Monks, who is putting forward big bucks for evidence that Oliver has become a criminal. Nancy again is behind Oliver and puts it into her power to try to help him when the time comes. Character-wise, Sykes' evil becomes more boundless every time he is on scene, with images of him abusing his dog, Nancy, and almost everyone he comes into contact with. He has considerable power in the ring, but in an unusual additive by Dickens, it doesn't seem that power has corrupted him so much as a life in poverty. Then, when Monks, supposedly a higher-up in the chain, is introduced, nothing changes about the way Sykes is viewed. Perhaps the view makes Sykes even more sinister for being so naturally despicable. Oliver settles in with his new friends and learns to read and write in the country. There seems to be something brewing plot-wise based on subtle hints from conversation, but that is all waylaid by both Rose Maylie's illness and Oliver's discovery by Monks and Fagin. They go back to London, where Nancy manages to warn Rose of Sykes's plan at the expense of her life. Again, Nancy, as the book progresses, seems to have more and more layers. She becomes religious in the end and wants nothing from Rose but Oliver's protection. She too, it seems, is pure of heart, even though she claims to be fully wicked and beyond help. Oliver, meanwhile, is finally put in a position of giving rather than taking to survive, and he flourishes, attempting to do everything he can and more for the people whom he loves. Somewhere in here, there are a few chapters about Mr. Bumble, who marries a strong-willed woman who is also employed at a child farm, but then falls into despair at the end of the book. We learn truly how stingy and weak-willed he is, especially compared to his wife in these chapters. Alrighty, now for the ending. Major, major spoilers ahead. It turns out that Oliver is actually Monks' brother, and the reason why Monks was trying so hard to incriminate Oliver was because he wanted to secure the family fortune. Fortunately for those involved, though, Oliver has some strong friends who intimidate Monks into cutting the fortune evenly. Now Oliver's circumstances match his demeanor. It is noted that he is very much like his late mother, whose identity is also revealed at the end. Dickens ends with a lovely summary overview of all the characters' fates, starting with Sykes, who accidentally hangs himself when trying to escape the police for Nancy's murder. Unfortunately, his poor dog met a similar fate as well. Oliver, as I'm sure you are all wondering, lives a contented, well-off rest of his life, as far as we know, and is even able to visit his mother's grave on occasion, with Rosemary by his side, of course. I think that with such a tidy ending, evil being punished and good being rewarded, Dickens is ultimately commenting on his view of worldly balance, if not fairness, at least in the end. It is impossible to encapsulate a Dickens novel in one short episode, but I hope that this quick dive into one of his most notable novels has sparked your interest enough for you to want to read or at least appreciate Dickens a little more than you did before listening. I, of course, missed things about the plot, like the long and mysterious build-up sequences about Oliver's parentage and some other small details that would have ultimately solidified the ending for y'all. But this was an episode about character and a short one at that, so I hope the omission intrigued rather than stayed your curiosity. If you want to read along with me for next time, though, Saturday's episode is on A Tale of Two Cities. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, consider checking out the last episode where I discuss how to read a novel by Charles Dickens. This will be especially helpful to you if you are trying to catch up with our reading list. Next, A Tale of Two Cities, and then Bleak House, and then maybe a special surprise at the end of December. Everything DH and I can be found at didianandhawthorne.blueberry.net, except blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @didianin. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course the new projects and episodes relating to DH and I. The new year is coming up, so of course I'm going to be posting the list of books that I've read this year, 54 thus far, and a bunch of new reading lists, etc., etc., for the new year. It is an exciting, bustling time on Twitter for DH&I this season, so I hope to see you on the platform. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or any other guilty pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Tuesday's episode is going to be about how to read 52 books in a year or a book a week. See you guys then.